And you're listening to Saturday Morning Live. This is Radio Regent, and that was an interview done on Uruhu Radio, which is on Diasporic Music every Sunday, 2 to 4. And we're going to take a little bit of a music break, and then we're going to go to Amandla.
No escaping spring this year. Lines are drawn, the seed has fallen, the blade is opened wide. There's no escaping feet that dance, and courage now, like wounded flowers. Push through stony ground. There's no escaping spring this year. There's no persuading longer days, though darkness chases warmth, and memories will still return at night to harden earth. There's no persuading spring this year. There's no denying miracles. The sun grows warmer now, and infants bowed in holy prayer begin with light to feel and stir. There's no escaping spring this year. And now the winter's over and done. Somehow time that was lost is now won. And rains that shower the earth now subside, the ground green with pride is now full and pregnant with child.
This is Munzungu, live on CHRY. This is 105.5. This is Amandla, African Perspectives. And, of course, we have the host right next to me, Ahmet Lo. So I did want to first and foremost begin with an interview that we're going to have with Bill Fletcher Jr. To give you a quick background, he is a racial justice, labor, and international activist based in the United States. He is an editorial board member of BlackCommentator.com, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, the immediate former president of Trans Africa Forum, the co-author with Dr. Fernando Gabacin of Solidarity Divided, and the author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. So we're going to be speaking with him in a few moments, and of course, having the interview starting at this point in time. Go ahead.
Hello, Bill. Can you hear us properly?
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, good.
Thanks for being with us today, and it's a great pleasure to have you today. As we mentioned earlier in our introduction, you are the co-auditor editor of a new book called Claim No Easy Victory, about the legacy of Amilcar Cabral. So, Bill, just tell us very quickly why this, who Amilcar Cabral was, and why published this book 40 years after he was assassinated in 1974.
Well, thank you for having me on the program. Cabral was a revolutionary leader from Guinea-Bissau. He was actually Cape Verdean. And in the 1950s, he began initiating work that led to the development of a full-blown independence movement for Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, and they were both controlled by Portugal at the time. He was the main leader of the African Party for the independence of Guinea-Bissau and the Cape Verde Islands. And he was assassinated in January 1973 at the instigation of the Portuguese, but also involving a factional dispute that was going on in the PAIGC, in his party. Feroz Manji and I thought that it was very important to commemorate Cabral, because Cabral was not simply the leader of a movement. He was an amazing theorist. And he was a theorist of the challenges of national liberation. He found himself in Guinea-Bissau working with others to wield together these different ethnic groups into a self-conscious nation that was capable of defeating the Portuguese. He was challenged by an issue that confronted every national liberation movement, which was an effort to reconnect with its own history, but not turn its history into some sort of mythology. And this was very, very important, because there was this tendency, there is a tendency, for people that are fighting against colonialism and other forms of national oppression to mythologize their own past, to turn it into something that it wasn't. And Cabral showed the importance of understanding one's history, understanding one's culture, not looking backwards, but as a way of moving forward. And we thought that that was particularly important. I guess another feature of why it was important, or it is important, to study Cabral and to commemorate him, is that Cabral was trying to not only defeat the Portuguese, but to lay the foundation for a post-colonial emancipatory state. And I think that we have to acknowledge that that failed. That Guinea-Bissau, after largely defeating the Portuguese and gaining independence in 1975, took a number of steps forward, but then retreated. And this is after Cabral had been assassinated. It retreated. And many of the important lessons from Cabral's teachings have, in fact, been lost.
Right. You mentioned Cabral as being a very acute theoretician of African revolution. One of the theme that he developed was in regard to the question of the African petit bourgeoisie as they arrived to in power, and the notion of class suicide. You know, can you elaborate a little bit on his vision of the role of the black or African bourgeoisie in post-colonial Africa?
Yes, it's very, very important, and in some ways I think it needs to be read in tandem with Frantz Fanon. What Cabral was arguing was that in Africa at the time, with a relatively small working class, very large peasantry, that the petty bourgeoisie, the intellectuals that emerged out of the merchant, the small producers, that sector, that they had a very, very valuable role, because many of them were the ones that were able to gain higher education, and they were able to gain access to much of the theory that theoretical works that were out there that the average person in Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde did not have access to. And so the petty bourgeoisie in Cabral's mind had a very important role to play in the African liberation struggle, if it was prepared to, as you said, commit class suicide, by which he meant that the African petty bourgeoisie needed to become a class that was no longer fighting in the interests of an aspiring petty capitalist class. It had to become an element of society that was merging with the workers and the farmers in order to form a truly democratic people's state. And that if it did not commit class suicide, that what it might do, and this goes right into the issues that Fanon was addressing, if it did not engage in the process of class suicide, because class suicide is not a one-act show, if it did not engage in the process, that what would happen is that after defeating the colonial oppressor, that it would then seek to become not a means for emancipation, but a new oppressor, a new ruling class. And in fact, that's what we've seen in many of the post-colonial African states, that class fractions that articulated, in many cases, very revolutionary language and alignments, once in power, did not continue the process of the revolution, but instead attempted to secure control. So that lesson out of Cabral and that lesson from Fanon remain incredibly important to this day.
All right. I'm going to just pass over to my co-host, Muzungu, who would like to ask also one question. So.
Yes, hello, Bill. Just a quick question. When it comes to Amilcar Cabral, I think what he really did well was to articulate a language to both the scholar and the non-scholar populations within his country. But what I want to ask specifically is this. What was the economic framework that Amilcar Cabral was trying to articulate to, you know, his fellow citizens? What kind of economic framework was he going to utilize to secure resources, to organize industry, but more importantly, to make sure that generational wealth would be a concept that would be understood across the board? Because I think it's definitely critical that we speak of him, not only to himself and his legacy, but also speak of what was the framework of an economic nature that would be utilized to, again, bring his vision forward, if you could answer that question.
I would say that the framework was that of a socialist, but that he was looking at the stage of the revolution in Guinea-Bissau as what is called a national democratic revolution. In other words, that the immediate objective was not the creation of a socialist Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, because there needed to be much more development that would take place in order to move actually into a stage of socialism, but that the direction of the revolution needed to be headed in that way, that it needed to be a pro-socialist process. It needed to be a process that was, in fact, looking to put power in the hands of the everyday person. And when you look at what the PAIGC was doing during the revolution, you see the elements of that. You see the transformation of the role of women, for example. You see the creation of various kinds of mini institutions that led to the emergence of a kind of people's power at the base. So the elements were there, and one would have hoped that after independence, that the process would have continued. The challenge, though, was that with Cabral's assassination, the weaknesses of the revolution in Guinea-Bissau then become much clearer, that there was a lot that Cabral was able to do almost through force of personality and because of the level of respect that was held for him.
Go ahead. We have just one more minute, so we can...
Okay. Yeah. So the problem then was that the leadership of the PIGC was insufficiently unified on this national democratic direction. And so when Cabral is taken from the scene, the door is then left open for military elements particularly to rise up and essentially to ultimately seize power in the name of a new petty bourgeoisie.
Right, right. Unfortunately, I think that's all the time we had for with you. We hope that we can get you here in Toronto to have a little bit deeper discussion about the legacy of Cabral when we are going to be having the launch of this book, very important book called Claim No Is Victory, and that you are a co-author of. So I would like to thank you very much for your contribution today, and looking forward to work with you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you so much to both of you, and I look forward to being in Toronto.
Have a good
day. Take
care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was the voice of Bill Fresh.
Please enter your destination number now.
And we're going to take a short musical break to get a connection with our next guest, who also was attended Guinea-Bissau in 1973 at the height of the anti-colonial struggle. And he was he's based in the U.S. and he have also been a contributor to this new book called Claim No Is Victory. His name is Richard Loban. We are trying to reach him as we speak. And again, if you want to have a look at the book, it is called Claim No Is Victory, The Legacy of Amilcar Cabral. And it was published a couple of months ago, I think early end of 2013. And it's a collection of over 40 different contributions of authors from all different walks of life, from different continents, from Africa, North America, Europe, you name it, with people like Angela Davis, Samir Amin from the Egyptian scholars, and lots of interesting contributions. So it's a very well-recommended book that I would recommend everybody to take a look. You can, I believe that it's being carried out here in Toronto by the different booklists, which is located at Bloor and Bathurst in downtown Toronto. But you can order it also, I believe, online from Amazon.com. And in the future, most like around April, May time frame, we are planning to have a launch of this book here in Toronto, and we at the time we're going to try to get Bill Fletcher to be here in Toronto, and then we're going to have much lots of more discussion around this very important historical figure of the African Revolution, Amilcar Cabral, who was from Guinea-Bissau. So looks like we have our next guest online. Richard, can you hear me properly?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And we just hung up with Bill Fletcher, and we were talking about this new book,
Cabral.
And I understand that you were in Guinea-Bissau in 1973-74, just after the assassination of Cabral. Tell us a little bit about how you came in contact with the PAIGC and Amilcar Cabral, and what was the atmosphere in Guinea-Bissau at that time?
Well, I came in contact because I was a longtime supporter of African liberation. I worked with Frelimo even earlier in Dar es Salaam in 1964, and Eduardo Mondlane, the founder of Frelimo, was my neighbor. He was actually murdered by the Portuguese in 69. And so I had been working for liberation of Southern Africa and Portuguese colonial Africa. And then I began working with Southern Africa magazine in New York, which was anti-apartheid magazine. And various members of our association would be assigned to cover Angola or Mozambique or Namibia or whatever. And my assignment was Cape Verde and Guinea-Bissau. So it was as a journalist for Southern Africa magazine that I went to Guinea-Bissau to see, you know, from the front line how things were. I had planned to go and meet Cabral, but of course, in the January 20th, he was assassinated. He had been in the States earlier at the end of 1972, but I didn't bother to meet him because I was going to meet him in Bissau. Unfortunately, I miscalculated and didn't meet him at all because of his
his death. The other thing, when I got to Guinea-Bissau from southern Senegal, from Casamance, from Ziguinchor, I met up with the guerrillas because I was being escorted with Amilcar Cabral's brother, Luis. And then when I got to the North Front, they said, well, maybe you just want to go, you know, some distance in and see how the liberated areas are operating. But he said, well, why don't you think about crossing the whole country on foot? So I said, sure. So I walked completely from the north side, from Senegal to Guinea-Conakry. And it was during that time that the Battle of Guillette was going on. So by the time I arrived in Guillette, it had fallen. And as you can see in the Cabral book, you know, I actually spent the night after the Portuguese had been driven out. So that's some ideas. And when I got to Conakry, then I met Aristides Pereira, and I stood exactly at the place, which was surrounded by white stones, where Cabral had been killed earlier that year.
Right. And you mentioned that having worked with organizations like Frelimo in Mozambique, and what would you say was the one of the main contributions that Cabral made into that anti-colonial struggle that made a difference in the case of Guinea-Bissau?
Well, there are a few principal contributions. First, Cabral was a brilliant thinker and a strategist. So not only did he see the concreteness and the special features of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, but he saw it in the context of the struggle against apartheid and against the colonialism. So when he was a central figure in the creation of the CONCP, Conferência das Organizações Nacionalistas Coloniales Portuguesas, then he was also a founder or co-founder of the MPLA. And so the sense of integration and comprehensive understanding, strategic understanding, political understanding, and the mission was his major contribution in terms of the political and military struggles of the from the founding of PIGC to you know, to independence, which he, of course, didn't live to see, but...
Right. I'm going to pass over the mic to my co-host, Moon Zongo, who would like to ask you a very quick question.
Yes, hi. Quick question for you. In terms of Amilcar Cabral and, you know, his ability to articulate things that people were thinking about but didn't really want to say, within his story, What was the main interest of the Portuguese government to be involved in this particular nation? What was their reason and their intent in reinforcing a colonial policy? What were they seeking to receive or gain from
the motivation of Portuguese
just
colonialism
from
itself?
Just curious.
Well, colonialism was, in a sense, in the 15th century, almost accidental, because they were only exploring the coastal and island enclaves around Africa as the original sailors were going along the coast. But quickly, they realized the significance of Cape Verde, and then Cape Verde was easy to dominate in a strategically strong position to dominate the coast. And, of course, for decades, there was no other European power competing with Portugal in the 15th and, early 16th century. So Guinea-Bissau was just strategically, an adjunct to Cape Verde. But then as the New World was discovered, it became a key source for slaves. And the Upper Guinea coast in general for the Portuguese was so important. Slaves that either went to the Caribbean or to northern Brazil, especially to Grão-Pará and Maranhão, and these kind of areas. Later on, Angola also was very important for the South Atlantic slave trade to southern part of Brazil. So So that's why the Portuguese were there. They, of course, tried to conceal their lust for economic and human resources by talking about the colonial mission of civilization, something like this. But in fact, when the Berlin Congress took place and Africa was partitioned, they only had toeholds on coastal enclaves. And, of course, later on, they tried to hold on to the remaining part, having been largely defeated by France and England in the occupation and colonialization of the African continent.
Right.
So that's a few highlights, I should say.
Yeah. We have two more minutes to go. Unfortunately, the time is running out. But I would like... Africa has been going on through some major challenges recently, with the most two visible threat being the threat of militarization, with the military intervention of French and U.S. Attempting to deploy its African bases across the continent. And this is coupled with another threat, that is the process of land grab, that is threatening to reverse some of the gains that were made possible by the National Liberation Movement. Why it is Cabral's contribution so important in this critical time of Africa trying to face these two major challenges, militarization on one point and the resource grab on the other side?
Well, as for the land grab, or let's call it the efforts by especially Asian and the Arab countries to have this rentier ownership. This is a big threat for sure. And that hasn't really provoked so much the militarization, but the militarization, particularly by NATO countries, or you mentioned AFRICOM, has been more in response to African security issues like Sahel presence of Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda affiliate groups. The U.S. itself is really not so much involved in the land grab. They actually have a fairly small footprint in Africa compared to Arabian countries and China, India, and these countries, which, of course, are not so much involved in the anti-terrorism, with the exception of piracy, which is another current threat that Africa is facing, either in the Horn or in the Gulf of Guinea. So those are just a few comments. Of course, I wish we had much more time, but a very complicated and rapidly evolving situation for sure.
And thank you very much for being with us today, and we really appreciate your contribution for this show, and we hope to continue this discussion another time. Thanks for being with us
today. My pleasure, because we have only touched the surface.
That's right, absolutely. Have a good day, and thank you very much for today.
Most welcome. Yeah. Bye.
Bye. That was my second part interview with Richard Lauban, and we might have a different appreciation on some of the role that the U.S. is being played right now in Africa, which we believe is very critical and very important, and that is there is an attempt to use the security question as a justification of the militarization process, but this have nothing to do with some of the ambition of U.S. getting food on the continent, so that they can continue the process of resource grab and then controlling economically the continent in order to continue to feed Western nations with the major resources that are necessary to uphold the level of consumption that a lot of people have been enjoying in the Western hemisphere. So, as well as some emerging countries are being very active in the resource grab in Africa, as well as the European countries and also in the United States. So we'll go to the...